Do I sense a buzz of anticipation here as you approach Thanksgiving? Okay, so today we finish up on chirality and go on to conformation, which is the last C. First, I've mentioned this before, I think, that I've worked for Azi and I've actually testified about Lipitor, but the only connection with AstraZeneca and Prilosec is that I take it occasionally, as I mentioned last time. Now, the sensitivity in the drug industry to stereochemistry, to the difference in reactivity of right and left-handed things, it's been known for more than 100 years. Emil Fischer, the guy who invented the Fischer projection, had the idea that things had to fit and what stereochemistry was. But in this so-called Bible of stereochemistry, which was written in 1994, there are in fact only 8 pages that have to do with the biological properties. This has become much more, the drug industry has become much more sensitive to the role of enantiomers in the last 20 years or so. Here's an interesting example from 2005. Remember, we talked last time about Nexium and how the fact that it's converted by mineral acid into something that's achiral makes it seem unlikely a priori that there would be a difference in the effectiveness of right and left-handed material, so that cheap omeprazole should do as good a job as expensive Nexium. And we showed that AstraZeneca really did a good job marketing Nexium. But anyhow, they got sued, and there was this note a few years ago from Dateline to Wilmington. A federal court in Delaware Tuesday dismissed a class action lawsuit that alleged AstraZeneca's misleading marketing of Nexium added billions to health care costs. The U.S. District Judge Sue Robinson rejected the suit brought by the Pennsylvania Employee Benefit Trust on behalf of the entities that foot the bill in health care plans. Now, why? According to the health plan paying organizations, the big difference between the two drugs is not effectiveness, but advertising. By selling doctors and patients on the idea that patented Nexium is better than Prilosec, which faced generic competition, AstraZeneca was able to preserve billions in sales. So in 2003, the mass media advertising budget for Nexium was $260 million by AstraZeneca. And in 2005, after they'd already gotten it introduced, it was still $226 million. But that's negligible compared to the sales, which were $5.8 billion, right? Two parts in 60, right? About 3% or something like that of the sales. Okay, Judge Robinson said that the courts should defer to the U.S. FDA in weighing the differences between drugs, and that since the FDA cleared Nexium's label, the lawsuit couldn't stand. So AstraZeneca keeps raking in the bucks on Nexium. And it could be that it's better. It's just that it seems to me that the trials didn't show that it was better, at least the ones I know about. So now back to chemistry. In order to do this job, to have Nexium, to sell a single enantiomer, obviously AstraZeneca had to be able to produce it, and they had to test it first. So how did they go about getting a single enantiomer? Because this shows you the ways people really do resolution. Okay, we already talked about various ways that Pasteur thought up, separating a conglomerate of right and left-handed crystals, just picking them apart with tweezers, or making temporary diastereomers. Pasteur figured that out as well. To destroy one enantiomer, Pasteur figured that out too, where the Penicillium glaucum ate up one enantiomer of tartaric acid in the racemic acid. Or you can do a reaction with a resolved chiral reagent or a catalyst to destroy an enantiomer, not just with biological things. Or you can prepare just one enantiomer, and that, as you can see, will have a big advantage. And you can prepare just one enantiomer, as we already said, by using a starting material that's only one enantiomer and not changing its chiral center. Or by using a reagent or catalyst that's resolved to get one enantiomer. So let's see how they actually did it, AstraZeneca. What tools did they use? First, when they wanted to get a little bit of omeprazole, the racemic stuff, resolved, they tried chromatography on silica that was coated with trisphenyl carbamoyl cellulose. They did this in 1990 when they could see on the horizon that their patent was going to run out, and if they could get a single enantiomer, it might help with a chiral switch. So that's the structure of cellulose. It's got a whole bunch of OH groups, and the OH groups can react with phenylisocyanate, that molecule shown there, in a way that doesn't surprise you at all. It's very much like the formation of urea, that the unshared pair on oxygen attacks the carbonyl, the nitrogen picks up a hydrogen. So it's very much like forming urea from ammonia plus cyanic acid. It's the same reaction. Okay. But anyhow, that happens with all of the OHs, so you get ORs all over. And it turned out that this solid, when that's what you put into the chromatography column, it's chiral because cellulose has all the same configuration of these stereogenic centers on the sugars in it. So when they used that as the column and injected omeprazole in six passes through the column, they could get 3 milligrams of plus and 4 milligrams of the minus enantiomer pure coming out the bottom. Now, that's not very much. It's not nearly enough for one human dose, which, as we saw last time, was 20 or 40 milligrams. Okay? But they could do something. So this wouldn't be a practical way to make the stuff commercially. But it was enough to test one really important thing, which is how fast it racemizes. Why would that be important? What does it mean to racemize? So now you've got two little vials, right? One has 3 milligrams of the plus, and another different one has 4 milligrams of the minus that you picked out coming out of the column. And they're going to test it to see how fast it racemizes. Why do they care how fast it racemizes? Yeah, if you make it and it racemizes in a millisecond, it was no point in resolving it, right? So it has to last long enough that you could make a pill out of it, or that when somebody takes it, it stays at that form at least a little bit. So they were able to measure the half-life for racemization. It's an hour at 75 degrees C. And from that, you can infer that it would be about 100 hours at room temperature in solution, right? So that's long enough. It's not going to racemize immediately in solution. Okay, so that meant it was worth going a little bit further. Had it racemized faster, you could forget it and forget your billions of dollars, okay? So now they needed a larger quantity. So what they did was make diastereomers reversibly, right? So they took mandelic acid, whose name comes from almonds, right, which has a stereogenic center here. It's a single enantiomer. The S comes from nature. Okay, but this acid, you might say, aha, we could make a salt between this acid and this unshared pair base, right? That's not so great, because that's activation by an acid like that is what causes this to rearrange, right? So that's not the best thing. But there's a way you can link those two together by adding a third molecule, which is formaldehyde, because this unshared pair can attack formaldehyde, and an unshared pair here can attack formaldehyde. In fact, as we'll see more clearly a little later on, both can do it. So that, in fact, you put the CH, you lose water, H from here and H from here, and put the CH2 group in between. So now they're linked covalently, right? But this is only S, whereas this sulfur here, remember, had the oxygen coming out and the oxygen going back. It was both R and S. But now we have two different molecules, S with S and S with R, right? And those are obviously diastereomers. They have different solubility and so on. So you can crystallize them apart. So they separated the diastereomers by crystallization. But of course, what they wanted was the drug, not this stuff and not that CH2. But it turns out you can take that apart again and get back to the original drug. Okay, so now you've separated it. So doing it this way with temporary diastereomers, they were able to get hundreds of milligrams, which was enough for some biological testing, right? And what they found was that the R enantiomer is four times as active as the S in rats. But curiously, it's reversed in humans, and the S is more reactive than the R. Isn't that curious? But at any rate, so it proves you have to test things in humans ultimately if you want to know how they're going to work. So anyhow, now they knew that that it was going to last long enough, and that one of them was a little bit more active, however you measure activity. Okay, so so that was making temporary diastereomers, but it's much more efficient not to do it that way, because you lose half the material, you throw it away. In fact, a person who was a postdoctoral fellow in our lab here 30 years ago or something like that got a job at a big pharma company, and his job was to take the stuff they were throwing away and undo the last few steps of the reaction, that is, do reactions that reverse the last few things. So then you could take it forward again and make the right stuff, or at least make half of the right stuff, right, so as not to have to throw it away. They had big mounds of this stuff that was the wrong enantiomer. That's obviously not efficient, right? So we could, that same thing as if you destroy one, but remember Levine's 1,3-butanediol made all the, he got all the stuff because there was an equilibrium between the two enantiomers, and he drained one of them off into product. Okay. But a much better way is just to prepare only one enantiomer. Right? So you could start with a chiral material, or you could use a reagent or a catalyst that was a single enantiomer. And that's what, in fact, AstraZeneca did in this case, and we're going to show you how that worked, by talking first about a different reaction, which turned out to be closely related. It was the model for what they did. Okay, this is using a chiral catalyst, which is, the catalyst is titanium. But it's chiral by virtue of having diethyl tartrate, our favorite chiral molecule, tartaric acid. Okay, now, everything white you see is titanium dioxide, right? And that can react with an alcohol to give a titanium with four OR groups on it, right? okay, but that, the OR minus can come off, right? And a different RO minus can come on, right? You can exchange one for the other. Now, a particularly good thing to exchange is to use an alcohol that's going to come on that actually has two alcohol groups. And in particular, if that one that you exchange for these two is made from tartaric acid. Remember, here's a CHOH, CHOH, and an acid on each end. Actually, it's the ester derived from the acid. It's diethyl tartrate. But anyhow, if you use a single enantiomer of the tartaric acid to do this, now the titanium is in an environment that's just one hand. Okay? Now, what do you want it to do? Well, you want it to lose this R to give that, and then put, instead of an alcohol, a peroxide, a hydroperoxide in there. Okay? So that comes in, and you get this. Now, what makes this reactive? Yeah? Didn't you tell me last time? Or who? Somebody told me. Yeah, was it there? The OO sigma star, okay? So, if you have something with an unshared pair, like pi here, you can imagine it's reacting with the OO sigma star. Okay? So, first, though, the oxygen replaces the OO, this alcohol replaces that alcohol the way we've been replacing all these other alcohols. So it's actually attached to the titanium at the time that the pi electrons here attack that LUMO. So the LUMO is just set as sigma star. The HOMO is the pi electrons. So they can shift up and attack that, and OR minus will leave. It's the reaction we always talk about. Okay? But there's an interesting second thing that can happen at the same time. Because there's a HOMO on this oxygen. What is it? Unshared pair. Think of the unshared pair that's in a P orbital that's coming in and out of the board. Right? So plus in front, minus in the back. So that would be a HOMO here. Where would you have a LUMO down here? Pi star, which would be plus in the front, pointed up, and minus in the back. Right? The node in between them. So those will overlap too. So the P orbital on oxygen can overlap pi star, and you get a second pair of electrons bonding between the oxygen and the double bond. So what you're going to do over here is put on an oxygen that has two bonds, two pairs of electrons. So it's a three-membered ring with oxygen in it. That's called an epoxide. And if it comes in from the top here, then it will be the R epoxide, right? Because that carbon there is chiral, stereogenic center. Now, you might say, aha, but we could have brought this in upside down. Right, and you could attack the other side of the double bond, which would then have it on the bottom. But notice that if you did that, if you had the precursor of the S epoxide, where the oxygen attacked the other face, then this CH2 group would be near this. Right? Not so great. So it's better to have it back the other way and form the R epoxide. So this oxidizing agent, this titanium with a peroxygen group on it, peroxide group on it, is an oxidizing agent, and it's a chiral oxidizing agent. It can choose which side of the double bond to attack. Now, this we had the guy who discovered this and who it's named after, who got a Nobel Prize for it, talked to the class a couple years ago, and you can see him on the web too if you want to, but this is a slide that he used. Barry Sharpless is his name. And he said so that if you use one enantiomer of tartaric acid, the O will come in from the top. If you use the other enantiomer of the tartaric acid, it'll come in from the bottom. Notice in this case he uses the diisopropyl group rather than the diethyl group that we talked about on the previous slide. But anyhow, he puts in this alcohol that has a double oxygen, a hydroperoxide, and titanium, and the tartaric acid, and mixes them up, and he gets a 70-90% yield. That's how much weight you get. But the stuff you get is greater than 90% enantiomer excess. That's how you measure how pure these things are. What that means is that the ratio of the R to the S, if that's the one you're trying to get, is 95 to 5. So there's 90% more of the one than there is of the other. So EE, enantiomer excess, is what people often talk about. Okay, so that's very good, 95% of the stuff you want. And it's general. Almost any, no matter what these R groups are, it will work. So remember last time when we talked about making the azide drug with the 19 centers, we said that some of the reactions we used were general, so people knew which enantiomer you'd get. For example, which of the tartrates you should choose in order to do that. Other ones, they just had to try and see which one would work. Okay, and as Sharpless gave a lot of credit when he spoke about this to Katsuki, his postdoctoral fellow who discovered this in Stanford University in 1980, and here they were celebrating this with a drink that turns out to be 5% L-tartaric acid in it. Okay, they had tried lots of things. They tried all these different metals to see if they would catalyze this. And what they found was, So that you take this double bond here, you want here two double bonds, but you want it to be selective to do that one, not to do the other one. So for metals catalyzing the epoxidation of allylic alcohols by this T-butyl hydroperoxide, that's the alcohol that has a double oxygen in it, they adding the tartrate ligand to make these various metals chiral always affects the reactivity. But the titanium, among all these, the titanium is the one where it actually accelerated it rather than slowing it down, right? So it just turned out that Katsuki, after trying 24 others, finally found one that did the trick. Okay, and there's the group celebrating and holding up a bag, as you can see here, of tartaric acid, 100 pounds of tartaric acid. Sharpless likes to work with things that are cheap and practical. Okay, and as you know, it's a byproduct of the wine industry, so fine. Okay, so now, AstraZeneca launched this Nexium, S-omeprazole, in 2000. This is, again, Sharpless's slide. But the way they did it was to use exactly this catalyst that Katsuki had developed for putting the oxygen on a double bond. So there was a lot of discussion about patent protection for this process and so on. And as it's fun to watch Sharpless's lecture for a number of reasons. One is he says, don't worry about patents. They never prove to be worth anything in the end anyhow. At least his. Okay, so now how does it work? How does the chiral thing work? Well, you put that in as we saw, blah, blah. We saw this. But this time we're bringing in sulfur. Now the sulfur has two electron pairs, right? This one sticking to the right and this one coming to the left. Those unshared pairs. So the question is, which one is going to be used to attack the oxygen and displace it in order to do this? Okay. In fact, I think I show this again, so I'm going to go through it quickly. I meant to take it out. But I'll say at this time that it's a catalyst. It's a catalytic cycle. Because when the sulfur, having done this, comes off, then you're ready to put another peroxide on and start the whole thing over again. So what you do, this is a little machine here. You feed in the peroxide, the oxygen that's going to go onto the sulfur. You feed in the sulfur. The OR minus comes out, so you've now left only with the O. The O goes onto the sulfur, which comes out. So it goes round and round and round, and you only have to use a little bit of the catalyst to get a lot of this stuff. But it's important that you get the right enantiomer, that the right one of these does the attacking. And when they tried this, with that chiral oxidation, they found that the product was racemic. It gave a 50-50 mixture. Not so exciting. But if they added this amine, this particular amine, and the AstraZeneca people tried this in the year 2000, they found that having done that, they got a 94% enantiomer excess. Right? So now they could go into business and make lots of money. Okay, now, let's look at once more at this. I'll go through it quickly. To note something that I hadn't shown before, which is that this other oxygen has an unshared pair, and that can be mixed with the titanium, a vacant orbital of the titanium as well. So in fact, this has a somewhat different structure, as you'll see, and the sulfur comes in and does that trick now, and the OR is still there. So I hadn't shown that in the previous cycle. And so this is the same thing we showed before, and it's a catalyst, and it goes around. Okay. Now, what had been discovered earlier in these other things was that often it was better if you didn't have the titanium on here, if this was an OH, right? So that one was racemic, but it was discovered by Cagan in Paris in 1983 that if you added water to this, it worked a lot better. Because the water replaced the titanium, put in OH instead of O titanium here. Sorry, that one didn't get blacked out, right? But still, it was racemic, even if you added water, right? And that was on the basis of adding something like that, that these guys in Sweden decided to add the diisopropylamine. Now, what does the ethyl diisopropylamine, that's called Unig space after a German chemist who used it a lot, what is it that it does in order to get 94%? So I had written this slide before and said there was no obvious reason for that. So when Sharpless spoke here, I asked him if he could tell us. And he sort of waved his hands. You can look at the lecture. And whether you find it convincing or not, I don't know. But last year, an X-ray structure was published which helps out with this. Or, pardon me, it wasn't an X-ray structure. It was a quantum mechanical calculation by a guy named Szabo, who was working in Sweden with these people at AstraZeneca, to show the calculated structure for the sulfur, So here's the sulfur with two things on it. The sulfur has a methyl group, and the sulfur has this heterocyclic ring with the two nitrogens, the imidazole, which is attached to something up here, back behind, which, and it's hard for me to see now, but anyhow, it's connected here through here, I guess, to the titanium. Okay. And here is the same thing, the sulfur attached to methyl, attached to the ring with two nitrogens, attached to the thing that comes up and attaches to the titanium. But there's a difference here. Here the methyl is on the left, here the methyl is on the right. So here the sulfur is exposing one of its unshared pairs, and here it's exposing the other unshared pair. Right? So this is which unshared pair gets attacked. Now let's look at the other parts of this. So the titanium is the thing that's in purple there. Okay? And here is the group that's going to get oxidized in one arrangement or the other arrangement. Notice that these just differ by the phase of rotation around that bond there. Right? If you could rotate this over to there, rotate around that single bond, and you have it there. And it, you would then expose one or the other unshared pair on the sulfur to what's on top. And what's on top is that peroxide group. These two oxygens attached to an R group here, both oxygens attached to the titanium. That's what I showed you on the previous slide. Okay, so you could imagine this one attacking to give one enantiomer, or this one attacking the oxygen to put the oxygen on the sulfur to give the other enantiomer. But now, over here, also attached to the titanium, is in this is a calculation, bear in mind. They don't want to put too much stuff in there. What was actually used was a nitrogen that had a methyl and two isopropyl groups on it, much bigger than this. Okay, but in this calculation, there's the methyl groups attached to nitrogen. And now look at the difference between this. If you fill out this methyl group and the methyl group that's on the sulfur and this methyl group that's on the T-butyl, there it is in one case, and here it is in the other case. They've gotten much closer to one another. Crunch, right? And in order to avoid that crunch, the thing adjusts its position a little bit. And notice the SOO geometry. SOO. In this case, it was linear, right? It went right at the back of that sigma star bond. But in this case, that crunch made it bend a little bit. It's bent by 7 degrees. So that makes this one slower than this one. And you attack one unshared pair more than the other. This, remember, is just a calculation. And in the real stuff, these groups are even bigger over here. So it's even more so. So that's presumably why adding that magic ingredient made it go all one way. Okay. But notice what we've done is introduce something entirely new in the molecular model that we haven't talked about before. And that's the interaction of groups through space. Right, this crunch phenomenon. And also we're talking about differences in arrangement involving rotation about single bonds, not what's connected to what way R or S at a stereogenic carbon, but differences that involving phases of rotation around single bonds. So this is our last C. Remember we had composition, constitution, configuration, but the last one is conformation. Okay? And notice that the distinctions are based on the molecular model we made for things, when we say what's connected to what, how they're arranged in space, and how they're rotated around single bonds. Now bear in mind that to get from one configuration to another at a carbon, you have to break a bond and remake it. But to get from one conformation to another, you just have to rotate about single bonds. And remember, that's what Paterno talked about in the dibromoethane, whether there would be different isomers for different phases of rotation in ethane. So that's generally hard to do, and this is generally easy to do. So normally, people don't consider stuff about Paterno. They talk about Van't Hoff, or at least they did. But now people are much more interested in the type of changes you can get by rotating around single bonds. So although Van't Hoff said you can rotate easily, Conformation involves rotational isomerism about single bonds. It's more subtle, requires more quantitative thought about equilibria, rates, and energies. So this is where energy is going to come into the course in this last quarter of the semester. Okay, so 1950 was when conformational analysis came in, and people began thinking in a serious way about phases of rotation, about single bonds. And this was modeled not by quantum mechanics initially, but by molecular mechanics, which treats atoms as if they were connected by springs that have a given stiffness for bending, for stretching, and also space through space interaction that we're talking about when we looked at those methyl groups running into one another. But you see, this is much more recent than the structural stuff we're talking about before, which was all in the 19th century. This started about 1950, okay? And here you are, remember? And there are Bartlett and Conant. And remember, it's physical organic chemistry. So now that we're talking about energy, there's more physical stuff about it. I hear you groan. Okay. And the reason was that Conant was then taught by Richards, who studied with Ostwald, but this little group of people here are the ones who invented physical chemistry beginning around 1885 or something like that. They started doing things that became physical chemistry. Okay, so in the late 19th century, organic chemists focused their efforts on molecular structure, this stuff about Van 't Hoff, how many isomers there are going to be and so on. Configuration. But physical chemists focused on energy, and sometimes to the exclusion of structure. So these were two completely different populations of chemists, and they didn't interact very fruitfully with one another many times until people started being trained in both things, the physical organic chemistry. Okay, for example, in 1907, Wilhelm Ostwald, one of the founders of physical chemistry, as we mentioned, wrote this book. He wrote a zillion books, but he wrote this book called Principles of Chemistry, an introduction to all chemical texts. So the idea was, you read this book, and then any other chemical text you read is going to be a piece of cake because you know all the fundamentals, right? So this was published in 1907, right? And this, on page 421, there's this rather long footnote. And if we look at this little bit of the footnote here, and look at it in English, it says, Dalton, who developed the law of combining weights on the basis of a hypothesis he had proposed about the composition of matter from atoms, at first took hydrogen as unity, since it had the smallest, quote, atomic weight, that is, combining weight. Now notice that he uses the word here, atom, atomen, here, right? But in all 554 pages of that introduction to all chemistry, this is the only place that the word atom occurred, right? It was all about energy for Ostwald. He thought atoms were not proven. In fact, 2 years later, he finally accepted atoms. But bear in mind, this is more than half a century after Cooper talked about things, and much longer after atomic weights were being measured and so on. Okay, so here's the dedication of our laboratory in April 1923, and people gathered on the front steps. And this group here, if we blow them up, you can see what influence Ostwald had, this guy that didn't believe in atoms. These guys were all students of Ostwald and very distinguished. He's from University of Toronto, from Harvard, from a British university, I forget which one, and from Cornell. And this guy over here with the cigar, you may recognize, do you? That's G.N. Lewis, who was a student of Richards. So all these guys were students of Ostwald. And Bancroft, the guy that was up here from Cornell, wrote an obituary of Ostwald. He also wrote the obituary of Van 't Hoff, in which he said that he never did it, not like to do any experiments. How nice it was, other people would do that for him. But in his obituary of Ostwald, he wrote, Ostwald's gift for leadership showed itself in the way his pupils regarded him all throughout their lives. They usually believed what Ostwald said, even when they knew he was not right. Okay, I think that's cute. Okay, but was he so focused on energy? He became fixated on energy because he was so impressed by the guy who lived here. You know who that was? Did you ever look here on this wall? Do you recognize where this is? How many of you walked by there this morning? Did you look at the wall here? Look at it next time, right there. It said, here stood the house of Josiah Willard Gibbs, class of 1858. So there's J. Willard Gibbs in 1855. So just as he was graduating from Hopkins Grammar School over here and entering Yale, right? And here he is later in life. That's a picture you're more likely to see of him. Now, physical chemists were and are quantitative about things. They're quantitative about equilibrium constants, the K. And they're quantitative about rate constants, how fast things happen, little k. And they're quantitative about energy, E, and how these things relate to one another, how energy differences relate to equilibrium constants and rate constants. So energy determines what, in principle, can happen, where an equilibrium constant will be. If you have something that's more stable, then you're not going to be able to get at equilibrium, use that as a starting material and get something that's less stable. The equilibrium constant is against you, but you can make it go the other way. So equilibrium constants tell you that. And here's an interesting thing. The equilibrium constant is the exponential of the difference in energy divided by KT, Planck's constant in there. I think you've seen that before, have you? Okay. But what you may not have seen is how to actually use this in your head, which is, if you make the energy in kilocalories per mole and talk about room temperature, then this turns out to be very close to 10 to the minus 3/4 delta E. So suppose there are two things that differ by 4 kilocalories per mole. One thing is 4 kilocalories per mole more stable than the other one. What will the equilibrium constant be? How big will the equilibrium constant be at room temperature if they differ by 4 kilocalories per mole? What will it be? 10 to the third. Now, 10 to the negative third is, it depends on which way, you know, that's right, depends on which way you write it. But don't try to just use common sense. If something's more stable, the equilibrium constant's going to favor it, right? So then you'll not you don't want to just use tables and go nuts on it. Just look at the thing that's more stable. If it's then use 3/4 by how much it's more stable, 10 to that is the equilibrium constant. So it also determines how fast, and that's kinetics. So the rate constant measured in units, how many per second, right, is 10 to the 13th. So it's 10 to the 13th per second. That's pretty fast. That's how fast atoms vibrate, roughly. So you're not going to have reactions happen faster than atoms vibrate, right? So it's about how fast atoms vibrate times the same thing, right? Except that it has this double dagger there. And that's called activation energy. And that's the energy difference not between the starting material and the product, but between the starting material and the highest barrier you have to go over in order to get to product. So it's as if you had an equilibrium between the starting material and this highest point, how much of the stuff would be up there at equilibrium. And then you know how fast it's going, 10 to the 13th per second. That's how fast things vibrate. So you'll be surprised how many people, sophisticated people, you will amaze if you use this idea 10 to the 3/4 and tell them how fast a rate constant should be. It's just incredible. You can impress anyone that way. Almost nobody uses that. Okay, so it's 10 to the 13th, 10 to the 13 minus 3/4 of whatever that activation energy is. Okay, now, a conformation involves rotational isomer about single bonds. So how free, what is the barrier to this rotation? Pater Noe said there was, implicitly said there was no barrier at all. It just, or pardon me, said it doesn't rotate at all. There's a very high barrier. You can count these different isomers. Van't Hoff said it was completely free. You don't count those isomers. But what is the barrier actually, and how fast will it rotate? Okay, incidentally, in these pictures, notice that both Pater Noe and Van't Hoff drew atoms on the top carbon directly above atoms on the bottom carbon, both there and here, suggesting sort of implicitly, although they certainly weren't thinking about it, Pater Noe might have thought about it because he assigned reality to this, that the atoms would be most stable when they were closest to one another, right? But maybe they're most stable when they're furthest from one another, that is, rotated 60 degrees from that. See what I'm talking about? But it's interesting that both guys wrote it in what's called eclipsed. It's called eclipsed because if you viewed this from the top, the atoms on the bottom would be hidden by the atoms on top. Okay, in fact, a couple years ago, the molecule of the week, according to the American Chemical Society, was L-tartaric acid. And they drew this space-filling structure of it and this wedge dash structure. And both of those show the atoms directly above one another, the eclipsed conformation, right? This OH with this COH is directly above that. This OH is directly above the H that's coming out here, and so on. Okay. Now, the Newman projection is something you'll learn, which was invented in 1952 by a guy who got his Yale undergraduate degree in 29 and his PhD 4 years later, whose name was Melvin Newman, who taught for his entire career then at Ohio State. So he no doubt sat in the chair that several of the chairs that some of you are sitting in. Okay, now he had the idea of how you could draw a structure to show the phase of rotation around the single bond easily. So these are the hydrogens on a carbon that's in the back, sticking back away from us, and they'll be hidden by the carbon and the next carbon that are forming the single bond, and then we'll draw on the hydrogens that are coming out toward us. Now, if you were trying to make an artistic impression, you'd have these bonds start here and maybe end here on the surface of the sphere or something like that. But that's not the way you do it. You just, in the Newman projection, you just draw them all the way in. So that structure is called staggered because the hydrogens alternate as you go around front, back, right? But this one is what you'd draw if it were eclipsed, if the atoms in the front hid the atoms in the back. Now, of course, then you can't see what's behind, so you might twist it a little bit that way or twist it a little bit that way so it's clear what you're drawing as well as you want to express that it's eclipsed. It's not the Newman projection isn't ideal for drawing things that are eclipsed, but there's a good reason for that, is that it rarely occurs that things are eclipsed. They're almost always staggered, okay? Then when you have substituents front and back, they can be opposite one another, which is called anti in a staggered form, or they can be gauche, right? X and Y are near one another. But notice something interesting here. When they're gauche, they could also be that way. You know what gauche means in French, I'm sure. Some of you do. It means left. So if this one's left, what would you call that one? Droit, right. But they don't, right? They're both called gauche, and I don't know why. I don't know who thought that up. But anyhow, these are chiral, but not chiral by having a carbon with four different things. Chiral because it's twisted in one way or the other. It's a conformational difference, not a configurational difference. Okay, so there's a minus one and a plus one. Okay, this one, when the X and the Y are directly over one another, it's called syn, as opposed to anti, or sometimes fully eclipsed. And then if it's like this, it can be right or left, it can be plus or minus, but it's not fully eclipsed. And in fact, if you want to be really pedantic about this, you can see what these committee members of the Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, who think up nomenclature, do. They say if you have something in front that's here, and something in back that can be any place around the clock, around the compass, right? That if the thing in front is here and the thing in back is directly behind it, that's 0 degrees and it's called syn periplanar. right? If it goes as much as 30 degrees plus or minus, it's still called sin periplanar. But if it gets beyond 30 degrees up to 90 degrees, it's called sin clinal plus or minus. If it goes between 90 and 150, it's anticlinal. And if it's between 150 plus and minus 150, it's called antiperiplanar. And almost nobody uses that. But it's available if you want to talk about it. Okay, pretty pedantic. Okay, but now there's a question that we're going to end with, and we'll give you the solution. You'll have to wait until after Thanksgiving vacation. Sorry to keep you in suspense all that time. Okay, so here's the energy, and here are the various torsional angles as we twist through 360 degrees from being fully eclipsed. Okay, now, the energy could be like that, very small barrier, and it would rotate easily. Perhaps the lowest quantum level would be above this, and there would never be anything that was frozen, right? Or it could be a big barrier, and it would get stuck. So how big is the barrier, right? If it were this big, then you'd have a number of quantum levels in it. So the lowest energy states would all be stuck in one or the other, okay? Or it could be like this. Which is it? Is it like this, Van't Hoff-like? Or like this, toward Paternò? Or like this, and Paternò is really right about these barriers? Okay. So next time we're going to show you how it was discovered that this is about what the energy spacing is to have those quantum levels. So we'll do that next time. So the question is energy quantized in a triple minimum? Okay, I hope you can bear up over Thanksgiving.
Why are the eclipse confirmations low energy and the staggered confirmations high energy?
Oh, who knows? Could be the other way. Incidentally, it could be the other way around too, right? What I'm drawing is what Van't Hoff and Paternò drew, that eclipsed is the minimum of energy, right? It could be that the other is the minimum of energy. So we have to find out somehow. But again, you'll have to wait. Sorry. Enjoy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I know.